The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Activating Better Care in Sickle Cell Disease, Guidance on Novel PKR Agents, Other Innovative Therapies, and Modern Care Transitions. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/QHE860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
So you've just answered a question about the healthcare burden of sickle cell disease. Let's look at some of the supporting evidence. So sickle cell disease is an inherited red cell disorder. And what happens is when the oxygen is offloaded, that causes the hemoglobin to polymerize and the red cell to sickle. And this leads to downstream complications, including vaso-occlusion, intravascular hemolysis, and anemia. And as the red blood cell courses through the body, all of the major organ systems are affected, as can be seen in this cartoon from head to toe. All of the vital organ systems can have both acute and chronic complications. There are several different genotypes of sickle cell disease that we see, and it's really important to distinguish this from sickle cell trait, which is on the left-hand column. And the key feature here is that in sickle cell trait, we'll have more hemoglobin A versus hemoglobin S. About 3/4 of patients with sickle cell disease in the U.S. have SS genotype, and this is often termed sickle cell anemia. And here you should see predominantly hemoglobin S. They usually have a marked clinical severity with both hemolysis and vaso-occlusive complications. S-beta-0 presents very similarly to hemoglobin SS. And then the other genotypes to be aware of include hemoglobin SC, which represents about 20% of sickle cell disease, and hemoglobin S-beta plus thalassemia. And in both of these forms, you have a little bit more moderate of a phenotype, a little bit less hemolysis, is sometimes less vaso-occlusive complications. And then the other modifier that can affect sickle cell disease is having a very high fetal hemoglobin called hemoglobin S with hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin. Pain is probably the most common complication and presentation that our patients experience, and some on a day-to-day basis. It's important to distinguish acute pain from chronic pain. So on the left-hand side, you'll see things such as vaso-occlusive episodes, dactylitis or hand-foot syndrome, acute chest syndrome, and priapism as causes of acute pain. On the right, some of the causes to be aware of include osteonecrosis or avascular necrosis, most commonly in the hips and shoulders. Leg ulcers can cause severe pain, chronic back pain, osteomyelitis, neuropathic pain. And as the acute pain persists, you can have a change in the characteristics to something called centralization, where even mild noxious stimuli cause severe pain. Vaso-occlusive episodes are really important to understand because these cause the lion's share of the burden and healthcare utilization in our patients. It can be acute or episodic, somatic in nature. Most patients will have a typical anatomic distribution, often in the long bones. And if there's anything atypical about it, that should be a red flag warranting further workup. There can be interpatient variability as well as variation within that patient during different periods of life as their pain evolves. And again, this is probably responsible for over 90% of hospitalizations. And a recent report shown here in the table on the right shows that those that have vaso-occlusive episodes also have several other complications that are important to be aware of, because those can also compound the vaso-occlusive episode as well as the clinical course. So why are they important? Most importantly, for the patients, they impair their quality of life. This includes attendance in school, being able to maintain work, and just attend to a lot of their daily functional needs. It can also lead to severe life-threatening complications like acute chest syndrome, multi-organ failure, and even death. And in the cooperative study of sickle cell disease, or the CSSCD, which really taught us a lot about the natural history of sickle cell disease, those that were over 20 years of age and had 3 or more vaso-occlusive episodes per year were at a 2-fold higher risk of early mortality compared to those with less than 3 vaso-occlusive episodes per year. And here's some recent data, and there's a lot of data showing that those that have frequent vaso-occlusive episodes really cause a lot of healthcare costs and healthcare utilization. As you can see here very nicely, the more vaso-occlusive episodes that you'd expect, the greater care. And it's estimated that over $1 billion is spent annually to help care for the vaso-occlusive episodes in our patients. And there are several unmet needs that are related to the vaso-occlusive episodes. And this includes improved access to care, including transition programs, improving adherence to disease-modifying therapy that might help reduce the incidence of vaso-occlusive episodes, And then combination therapy, we have a lot of different targets, but perhaps including them together may have synergistic effects on the course of sickle cell disease. And then care delivery. And this is important both in the U.S. as well as globally. So you want to have access to quality care, culturally sensitive care, non-biased care, and then sickle cell disease treatment centers where you can have expertise in both the acute and chronic complications related to sickle cell disease are important. Let's now review the sickle cell disease management landscape with the focus on some newer developments that have increased our treatment options. So this timeline shows that there have been some advances in the therapeutic options for people with sickle cell disease. For a long time, we relied on hydroxyurea, penicillin prophylaxis, and transfusions to prevent stroke. But more recently, we've had some advances that include L-glutamine, crizanlizumab, and voxelotor for disease modification. And more excitingly, this year, we've had two different gene therapy options, lobocell and exa-cel, that have been FDA approved to help reduce vaso-occlusive episodes in people with sickle cell disease. This slide shows the different therapeutic approaches, and this includes both preventative approaches like vaccination, annual eye exams, pain management, or disease modifiers. But we're going to focus a bit more on curative therapies over the next few slides, including stem cell transplantation and gene therapy. And so this is the data from lobocell. And on the right, you can see the figure from the New England Journal of Medicine showing that severe vaso-occlusive episodes were substantially reduced. And a follow-up data was presented at ASH just last month showing that with 60 months of follow-up, 88% of patients had achieved a complete resolution of vaso-occlusive episodes. And 100% of adolescent patients between the ages of 12 and 18 were free of vaso-occlusive episodes. And this is with the lobocell approach that introduces a hemoglobin A that blocks the polymerization. The other approach is exa-cel. And here you're introducing a switch to the BCL11A that augments fetal hemoglobin. But very similarly, the rate of vaso-occlusive episodes post-infusion and engraftment are substantially reduced, as shown here. And this is updated data from ASH also in 2023 last month. And both of these encouraging results have led to the FDA approval in December of 2023. The other curative approach is stem cell transplantation. And over the past three decades, over 2,800 people with sickle cell disease have underwent curative therapy with hematopoietic transplant. And this systematic review from Iqbal et al. Shows that overall survival is about 96%, with about 90% cured from their sickle cell disease. When you look at a breakdown between pediatric and adults, you can see that the pediatric patients more often get myeloablative regimens, which may be associated with a little bit higher risk of graft versus host disease, while the adult patients get non-myeloablative approaches that might reduce the risk of graft versus host disease, but may be associated with a little bit higher risk of graft failure. Other long-term risks to be aware of and to consider include the risk of graft versus host disease, infertility from the conditioning regimen, and a risk of secondary malignancy. This table goes over the different disease-modifying therapies, starting with hydroxyurea, which has been around for about 30 years. And in the MSH study, it was shown to significantly reduce the rate of vaso-occlusive episodes, as well as the rates of acute chest syndrome and transfusion requirements. This was followed by L-glutamine, which is thought to improve the antioxidant systems in the red cells. It's a powder taken twice daily. This also significantly reduced vaso-occlusive episodes, followed by voxelotor, which is a hemoglobin S small molecule inhibitor that improves the hemolytic anemia and raises hemoglobin concentration, and crizanlizumab, which is an IV infusion. It's given every two weeks for the first month, followed by monthly thereafter. That also significantly reduced vaso-occlusive episodes. Importantly, all three therapies, L-glutamine, voxelotor, and crizanlizumab, were tested in about two-thirds of patients that were also on concurrent hydroxyurea, so it provided additional benefit to them. So what are some of the emerging therapies? And the two that are especially exciting are the PKR activators, etavopivat and mitapivat, and then some of the newer molecules that help increase fetal hemoglobin, including the decitabine tetrahydrouridine that helps increase hemoglobin F, and that's being studied in the ASCENT-1 trial. So you've just seen a question on PKR activators and sickle cell disease. Let's explore some of the evidence for this agent class. So what's known is that in sickle cell red blood cells, they have high levels of 2,3-DPG and low levels of ATP. And this is important because 2,3-DPG offloads oxygen from the hemoglobin. So high levels will cause more offloading of oxygen, while low levels of ATP can impair red blood cell membrane health, which is also an important feature of sickle cell disease. And so the PKR activators are thought to have two mechanisms of action that may benefit red cell health. The first is that by increasing the glucose metabolism, you lower 2,3-DPG. This allows more oxygen to remain bound to the hemoglobin, thereby inhibiting hemoglobin S polymerization. But it also leads to an increase in ATP, which can allow the red blood cell membrane to repair itself more efficiently. And so both mechanisms are thought to be important in sickle cell disease and potentially provide clinical benefit. So the potential clinical outcomes that have been evaluated are whether it improves hemoglobin concentrations, reduces hemolysis, and reduces rates of vasoocclusion. And as a proof of concept, when people have been treated with etavopivat, in fact, you do see that levels of 2,3-DPG go down and levels of ATP go up in the red blood cells. So in patients with sickle cell disease, etavopivat also led to improvements in hemoglobin concentration. As shown here in the first figure, you can see that patients had an improvement in hemoglobin, and this was sustained during the 12-week treatment period, with a maximum hemoglobin increase of 1.5 grams, and 11 patients, or 73%, achieving a hemoglobin improvement by more than 1 gram. Furthermore, all of the hemolytic markers that were assessed all showed improvement and a sustained improvement during the treatment period. Furthermore, the annualized rate of vasoocclusive episodes went down by about 68% in the 12-week cohort. And so looking compared to the rate prior to starting etavopivat versus on etavopivat, you can see that the annualized incidence rate went down and the rate decreased the longer the patients were on etavotherapy. Etavopivat was also well tolerated in this study of patients with sickle cell disease, with most of the adverse events being grade 1 or 2, and only one patient having grade 3 to 4 events, including COVID, an elevation in CPK, one patient with a DVT, and one patient with a syncopal episode. Similar to etavopivat, mitapivat works by activating pyruvate kinase. And it's shown very similar results compared to etavopivat. So here in an 8-week dose-finding study, sustained hemoglobin improvement was seen with a mean increase of 1.1 gram. Markers of hemolysis also decreased during the treatment period. And there was also a reduction in the annualized rate of vasoocclusive episodes, showing that this pathway may be really important in helping people with sickle cell disease. This was recent data presented at ASH in 2023, showing the RISE UP data. And here they looked at patients that had received 50 milligrams versus 100 milligrams and placebo in a waterfall plot. And so these positive changes represent an increase in hemoglobin. And approximately half of patients were hemoglobin responders, defined by a hemoglobin increase by more than 1 gram at both the 50 and 100 milligram doses, while as expected, most patients remained either increased or decreased in the placebo arm. And similar to etavopivat, mitapivat was generally safe and well tolerated, as can be shown here with the treatment emergent adverse events, both at the 50 milligram and 100 milligram arm, which is very similar to placebo. Consistent with this mechanism of action, not only improving hemoglobin, but being generally safe and well-tolerated in people with sickle cell disease. Now let's explore the potential future role of PKR activators in sickle cell disease. Susan is a 19-year-old patient with SCD, hemoglobin SS genotype. She has an active lifestyle but has fatigue. She also still has frequent vasoocclusive episodes, having 4 in the last 12 months, managing some of those in the emergency room. She's already tried crizanlizumab and L-glutamine to try to help reduce the rate of vasoocclusive episodes, but hasn't noticed much improvement. She does continue hydroxyurea at maximum tolerated dose, and compliance has been confirmed, but her hemoglobin is 8 during screening. So she's interested in emerging therapies and wants to learn about clinical trials, but she's also concerned about fertility issues because she does want to start a family after completing college. So one of the studies that could be discussed with the patient is the Hibiscus study. And this is the etavopivat phase 2-3 randomized double-blind global study that is evaluating the efficacy and safety of etavopivat. So the recruitment is currently ongoing, And there are different phases to this study. First, the dose determination phase, where people will be randomized to either placebo, etavopivat 200 milligrams or 400 milligrams, followed by an efficacy continuation period of approximately 274 patients, randomized to placebo or the chosen etavopivat treatment, and then a 52-week open-label extension. There's also a Hibiscus Kids study, and this is looking at etavopivat at 400 milligrams daily with a 24-week treatment period, followed by a 72-week extension treatment. It is a single-arm open-label study. And so some important things that you want to talk to the patient about. It's really important that clinical trials are brought to patients, especially once they've exhausted some of the FDA-approved therapies. But it's important to discuss the mechanism of action. A lot of our patients are pretty savvy and want to understand how these treatments work and how these treatments may help their sickle cell disease. So having that understanding may help augment their likelihood of participating. It's also important to discuss the risk-benefit profile. So most of these trials have been in phase 1-2 studies, so you can look at the safety profile. As we had discussed on a prior module, it's relatively well-tolerated, but these are some of the side effects to watch out for. Assuming that she does enroll in Hibiscus, it's also important to remember dosing considerations. This is really important to go over with the patient what the dose is going to be, how there's a dose-finding phase, followed by an efficacy phase at that most optimal dose, but also the timing that you want to take the medication, whether it's once or twice daily, whether you want to take it with or without food, or can you take it with other concurrent medicines, that's important to discuss, as well as if there are any potential interactions, like if they interact with any of the cytochrome systems, to be aware of other medicines and also over-the-counter medicines that they might take. And then compliance is critical for these studies, because if the patient is not taking the study drug, that's going to affect safety and efficacy outcomes. And so it's really important to discuss how that drug works, but also how you need to take it regularly to really understand the benefits and the risks of it. And so some strategies that we employ include calling the patient, doing weekly drug monitoring logs, and then having the patients come back with their bottle to make sure that they're returning with an empty bottle. And then the logs or their diaries also can capture day-to-day side effects that they may or may not be having while in the study. One other thing that's really important to discuss is also the toxicities of the treatment regimens. So in this case, the patient wanted to pursue a college and have a family thereafter. And so gene therapy is something that was also important to discuss with her, as well as the myeloablative chemotherapy regimen and its risks of fertility. And so being aware of all the different side effects of the different options are critical. And so for gene therapy, this was something that the patient deferred because of the chemotherapy risk and potential impacts on fertility. So transition of care is an important aspect of sickle cell disease management. Let's learn more about these concepts. So this figure shows a global approach for transition of care, including why it's important. So on the sociobehavioral factors, it's really important to understand self-management skills and to address those and educate the patient so that they have those when they transition to adulthood. It's also important to have patient engagement, because low patient engagement can negatively impact the transition in health. And it's also really important to maintain trust with your providers. And it's a tough phase, because the patient has been with a pediatrician their whole life, is now transitioning to a new provider. So establishing that trust is really critical for the successful transition. There are also health system factors, so making sure there are well-trained adult providers, and that's a big hurdle right now. Loss of insurance coverage, so part of the transition process is to make sure that insurance is continued from childhood to adulthood. Care coordination is really important. And then reimbursement is a problem, which probably ties into the lack of adult providers. Also during this period, end organ damage is starting to manifest. And so being careful about monitoring for end organ damage and treating it before it becomes too advanced is critical. And then other comorbidities also occur. And so both those related to sickle cell disease, but other ones such as high blood pressure will need to be managed to prevent kind of a synergistic adverse complication profile. So let's consider a 16-year-old patient with sickle cell disease who does not undergo timely transfer from pediatric to adult care. And this includes not having consistent care or education and is disengaged in their own care. And during this period, this patient is going to experience challenges with hydroxyurea, maintaining the dose and maintaining their prescription. The patient's going to have constant emergency room visits with their current vaso-occlusive episodes that are poorly managed. And in part because they're not on disease modifiers and having regular care, they're going to have trouble with their refills. And this may be due to insurance lapses. And this is really not an uncommon problem where patients don't have this smooth transition and experience all of these problems that are listed here. Now let's contrast to a 16-year-old who does undergo timely transfer from a pediatric to adult center, who does receive consistent care, education, and is engaged in their own personal health and shared decision-making. And so during this period, the patient's going to want to be on hydroxyurea and continue it, both because they're seeing the provider, they have their insurance coverage and the regular blood count monitoring and refills, but also understanding the potential benefits of hydroxyurea are critical. If the patient's having more vaso-occlusive episodes, this could be also an opportunity to add other disease modifiers that might provide synergy with the hydroxyurea and reduce vaso-occlusive episodes. And then this might, if the patient's having less vaso-occlusive episodes, they may have a better chance of maintaining attendance in school and progressing to job opportunities, college opportunities. With successful transition, the patient's also closely monitored for organ dysfunction. So in pediatrics, there's transcranial Doppler velocities. As you progress to adulthood, you want to monitor kidney function, cardiopulmonary function. Those are major organ systems that impact health as you get older. So it's important to track that as the patient transitions. And then consistent insurance coverage is critical so that you can get those therapies as well as monitoring and labs to assess the sickle cell disease. So the basic principles to help navigate transition of care include appropriate transfer over a recommended time interval. And usually this should be at least 6 months between the pediatric and adult care provider to allow that trust to build. Also education on sickle cell disease and self-management building skills so that the caregiver and their family are aware of what to monitor for. And here, the smartphone could be a really useful tool to help with daily reminders for medications, also for when you need refills, and most importantly, for your appointments. And then some systems use transition coordinators that help bridge this transfer of care from pediatrics to adulthood, making sure that all of those things like insurances and refills are being maintained. So there are several different resources that are available. Here we have the Sickle Cell Disease Association resources, and they have a nice list of different opportunities and things to be aware of for both transition as well as for general care of sickle cell disease. And for example, if you go back to our patient that was 16 years old, here's an example of some of the recommendations from the SEDAA, looking at things like encouraging the teenager to make their appointment, talking with them about privacy rights, making sure that they're involved in decision-making and medical summaries, having a family voice, and then also if they want to transfer to a new doctor for adult care. So some final thoughts on the modern management of sickle cell disease include vaso-occlusive episodes are an important cause of morbidity and mortality. There are some recently approved therapies which make it a really exciting time for sickle cell disease care, including curative gene therapies, as well as the PKR activators that are currently under phase 2 and 3 trials, including etavopivat and mitapivat, and hemoglobin F inducers. It's also really important to remember that clinical trial enrollment is really critical to help increase and advance the care of sickle cell disease. So it's important to know how to talk to patients about clinical trials. And then transition of care from pediatric to adults is really a critical time where patients' health can deteriorate if that transition does not occur smoothly. And it really requires a multidisciplinary approach and shared decision-making with the patient to empower that patient in their own care of sickle cell disease.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partner, Sickle Cell Disease Association of America, Incorporated. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/QHE 8860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated.